Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Very good evening to you one and all. It's very good to see a packed house here in holiday time or mid-July, so late July now. Anyway, I'm Tony Travers, Associate Dean of the School of Public Policy and Professor in the Department of Government, and I'm really here to chair this evening's event. We're going to hear about his new book, Can We Be Great Again? Why a Dangerous World Needs Britain, from Sir Jeremy Hunt. And I'll just very briefly introduce him, then what we'll do, the pattern for the evening will be Sir Jeremy will give a speech. You want to wander around and talk to the audience, then talk about the book, and then he'll come and rejoin me over here. I'll ask one or two questions, but then there'll be plenty of time for anybody in the audience to try and get through as many questions as we can. So, just very briefly to warm us up, Sir Jeremy grew up in Surrey and had a successful business career before turning to politics. And in a world, I can say this, where it's often said that people go straight into politics, nothing wrong with that. It is interesting that, you know, there are still people who have careers before politics and then go into politics. At the 2005 election, he was elected as MP for South West Surrey, and subsequently, towards the end of the Conservatives' period in opposition before winning with the creating the coalition in 2010, was successively Minister for Disabled People, Shadow Secretary of State, and then Shadow Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport. And then when the coalition took office, first was Secretary of State for Culture, Olympics, Media and Sport, and then went on to become, famously, Secretary of State for Health and then Health and Social Care, and became the longest-serving Secretary of State for Health in British history. He was then appointed Secretary of State for the Foreign Office at Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs before going back as a backbencher to chair the Health Select Committee, which is an unusual move, I think it's fair to say, and then, last but not least, after the complications, let's put it delicately, of Liz Truss's government, became Chancellor of the Exchequer, a role he held stabilising the ship until the 2024 general election. At that election, his constituency changed, so he's now the MP for Godalming and Ashe. I must say it's fair to say that a fair number of commentators, including me, thought it was going to be a close-run thing in that election. But in the end, it was a close-run thing, but Sir Jeremy got back. And he divides his time between Westminster and his constituency home in Hambledon, which, as I take it, is where cricket was invented. Is it that Hambledon or another one? It's another Hambledon. Okay, right, well, I was just trying out summer time to ask that kind of question. Anyway, enough from me. So, can we be great again? Sir Jeremy Hunt is going to tell you about his new book. So, over to you, Jeremy.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much indeed, Tony, and it's lovely to be here, and I'm very flattered there's such an enormous audience, and I think we're going to have a really good discussion, and this is actually quite an emotionally significant room for me, because the very last time I came here, I was Health Secretary, and it was in the middle of the junior doctors' strike, and as someone doing Tony's role at the Buxton International Festival last week kindly reminded me, this was 2016, there was a YouGov poll that asked who the most unpopular politician in Britain was. That was me, and I came and gave a talk here as Health Secretary, and there were a lot of protesters outside the building with placards, and they were expecting me to arrive in a ministerial limousine, you know, maybe with some police or something like that. And I actually arrived on my bicycle, wearing a helmet, and none of them recognised me. And I calmly locked up the bike and walked straight through the middle of them and came in here And they were so furious that they ended up storming the lecture. And so we had quite a moment. In fact, there's a gentleman here who's kindly guarding the entrance there. But he actually remembers that occasion. So this is my chance to say thank you to him. Apparently it's immortalized on a YouTube video somewhere. So I didn't know that until this evening. So it's lovely to be back. I think it's lovely to be back. I think that the thing we're going to talk about, I hope, you will find a really interesting discussion. And I just want, I know we're going to have questions at the end, and I just want to, I can tell you right now, there's a question on all of your minds, which I want to answer straight up front. You can still ask it again if you want to. And that is, if you think all these are brilliant things that we should do, why didn't you do them in 14 years in office? And I want to give you the truthful answer to that question. And it is this: when you are in office, you don't know the answers. I mean, if I tell you, when I became Chancellor of the Exchequer, I was on holiday with my wife, Lucia, having a date weekend in Brussels, which of course delighted Nigel Farage and all the conspiracy theorists. And I got a text from Liz Truss, from an unrecognized number, saying, "This is Liz Truss here. Please call." And I thought, it has to be a hoax. You can't possibly, she can't possibly. I knew that the government was in difficulty with a mini budget, and there were lots of rumours about a cabinet reshuffle, but I genuinely thought it was a hoax. And I said to my wife, Lucia, who was brushing her teeth, "I can't believe people still think I fall for these hoaxes." I then got a call from an unrecognised number, which was actually the Downing Street switchboard. But I thought it was a journalist, so I zapped it, and we went down and had a lovely breakfast. I think I had French toast, and then finally a friend called me and said, "No, I think Downing Street really is trying to contact you." And, you know, that evening, I was Chancellor, and it was not just Chancellor, but I was Chancellor who had never held an economics portfolio before. You know, I'm ashamed to say this in front of Tony, but I really knew absolutely nothing about how the money markets moved. And I had a business background, but that's not the same as the financial markets. And the financial markets were collapsing at that time. And I was suddenly in charge. And so I became Foreign Secretary for a year between 2018 and 2019. And this is the book I wish someone had given me the moment I became Foreign Secretary. I'm going to do another book next year, and if you're kind enough to invite me back, I'd be delighted to come back about, which will be the book I wish I'd been given when I became Chancellor. But the truth is that when you do a job, and I don't want, by the way, I want to strengthen your belief in democracy and open societies and freedom tonight, which is why, by the way, I genuinely welcome any questions, the more difficult, the better, because I think that's the point of places like LSE. But, you know, this is the truth, that when you do a job like Chancellor or Foreign Secretary or Health Secretary, your day is answering questions about your brief, whether it's questions in Parliament or in the media or at conferences. All day long you're answering questions. And you think you know it all. You really think you're a bit of an expert just because you're, you know, if you don't know the answer the first time, you work it out the second, and you get quite good at it. And it's only when you start to write a book that you realise you didn't know half of it. And so that's why I decided to write these books. It's in a way a form of therapy for me. You know, this is, you know, a chance to really think things through. And when you're Foreign Secretary, you know, I became Foreign Secretary on a July evening in 2018. Theresa May was Prime Minister, and Boris resigned over the Brexit, Theresa May's proposed Brexit deal. And I was welcomed to the Foreign Office by the Permanent Secretary, who's the most senior civil servant in the Foreign Office, someone called Sir Simon MacDonald, who's now Lord MacDonald. And he takes you up the grand staircase in the Foreign Office, which really is grand. And he gently slipped into the conversation. I was the 64th Foreign Secretary in the history of the United Kingdom, just to sort of put me in my place. Then he shows you this office. And the Foreign Secretary's office is the most grand office of any government minister. It's probably three times bigger than the Prime Minister's office. It's like a beautiful gilded room at the British Museum. And there in a corner is your desk. And when you're not entertaining for lunch and you ask for, you know, a Pratt lunch, it arrives on a silver platter. And the truth is that when you go into that office for the first time, the thought crosses your mind, and I'm sure it crosses every Foreign Secretary's mind, and I'm sure it crossed David Lammy's mind as well. The thought crosses your mind, is this just an imperial delusion? Are we kidding ourselves that we have influence in the world? And you go around, and of course you have your spiel as Foreign Secretary, and you're telling everyone that we have lots of influence in the world, and we're very, you know, great country and all that. But that question is in the back of your mind. And I decided to write this book to get to the bottom of that question. And Can We Be Great Again is quite a MAGA-sounding name, and I'm not, I think most of my friends would say I'm probably not the definition of a MAGA conservative. But I don't think Donald Trump should have a monopoly on the word great. And I want to tell you what my definition of the word great is right at the outset. For me, a great country is one that can shape the world as well as be shaped by it. And what I did in this book is I took all the biggest challenges that the world faces, global challenges. So I didn't look at sort of purely domestic challenges like, for example, the future of social care or something like that, but I looked at global challenges. So, for example, European security, given what Putin is doing in Ukraine, or the future of democracy, given the rise of China, or climate change, or the global migration crisis, or the future of human rights, or AI. I looked at all these issues, and what I found when you look at the evidence is that out of 193 countries in the United Nations, even now, with all our profound problems and challenges, which, by the way, I don't minimize in the book at all, but even now, without doubt, in every area, the experts say that the UK is one of the top 10 most influential countries, and often in the top five. And, you know, if I, for example, European security, the UK has by far the most respected military in Europe, the most battle-hardened, the most battle-experienced, and we've been given by far more support to Ukraine since the invasion, military support, than anyone else bar the Americans. If you look at the future of democracy, because 20% of the world understands English, the British media has disproportionate influence globally. It means, unfortunately for us politicians, that we are the world leaders in washing our dirty linen in public. When there's a problem in Westminster, the whole world knows about it. But it also means, when it comes to advertising how it works in an open society and how, you know, democratic debate can happen, Britain has a lot of influence. When it comes to technology, which is going to shape this century, London and San Francisco are the two global hubs for AI, alongside perhaps Beijing and Shanghai, but in the Western world, it's London and San Francisco. And we have the third biggest tech sector outside the United States and China. When it comes to preventing a pandemic in the future, medicines and vaccines discovered in the UK save more lives globally than those from any other country. Pretty remarkable achievement. And, you know, when it comes to climate change, I think we're ranked third globally behind Denmark and the Netherlands for our commitment to climate change. We haven't cracked the issue of how to make energy cheap as well as green, which I think is the next big thing that we need to think about. But in all these areas, the UK has considerable influence. And at a time when it's not clear if it comes to, for example, standing up for open societies, democratic values, freedom, that President Trump is particularly interested in showing leadership, then I think those countries that do believe in those values need to step forward. And I think it's even more important that they do. And so let me put it this way. If this was an audience of Australians or Americans or French or Germans or Japanese, I would make exactly the same argument. This is not an argument that Britain is in any way better than other countries. It's an argument that in an incredibly dangerous world, countries that have influence need to use it. Because if on the cover of the book, I'm just going to borrow your copy, on the cover of your book, there is a tortoise with a Union Jack shell. And what I'm saying is this is not the time, with the world as dangerous as it is, to retreat into that shell. And let's just reflect for a moment just how dangerous the world is. So, you know, one of the most common measures for how peaceful the world is the number of people who die every year in conflict, in war. And in 2018, I went to the United Nations General Assembly, and I remember listening to a speech by Theresa May, who was Prime Minister, to the United Nations General Assembly, in which she said how proud she was that the number of deaths in conflict in that year, 2018, were the lowest there'd been for 30 years. Unfortunately, since the invasion of Ukraine, that has changed. Since 2021, we've had about 200,000 deaths in conflict every year. That is a higher level than it has been since the 1940s. And let me just put, you know, these are just numbers, but let me put that in perspective. That is the equivalent to the number of deaths in the 9/11 terrorist attack happening every single weekend, every single year, for every single one of the last 4 years. We've been having the equivalent of that number of deaths happening. And that's one particular danger. Another is that we have a leader in China who is open about his belief that open societies, democracies don't work. And, you know, if Xi Jinping was with us this evening, you know, he's not a dictator. And I think this is a really big mistake to sort of say that he's a dictator like Gaddafi or, you know, Saddam Hussein or someone like that. He is someone who believes completely rationally that democracies are not capable of taking long-term decisions and that autocracies serve their people better. And sometimes he's right. And there is a global argument now between democracies and autocracies. And for me, the most worrying thing is that when Ukraine was invaded, I was expecting democratic countries from all over the world to line up behind Ukraine. What actually happened? Europe, North America, NATO, absolutely solid. But Africa, the whole of Africa, all the new democracies in Africa, most of South America, sat on the fence. And so we have far from won the argument that freedom, open societies, secure borders is the right way forward. Climate change. Tomorrow, 22nd of July, very important day in my family because it's my daughter's birthday. Last year, the 22nd of July, was sadly different for another reason, because it was the hottest day on record. But here's the, it's been breached since then, but here's the scary thing. The 22nd of July, 2024, that was the hottest day at that point, but that record in the previous year had been breached 57 times. So just in 1 year, we'd breached the record for the hottest ever day 58 times up until July the 22nd. So there is a huge climate crisis that we have to recognize. And then in all of this, you have President Trump, who is the most unpredictable American president in history. And I'm not someone who believes that he is all bad, and maybe we'll have a good discussion about some of the things that we need to do to understand President Trump better. But I thought I might just wrap up this introductory bit of the talk by telling you about the first time that I met Donald Trump, because I think there are some insights there. So I became Foreign Secretary on a Monday night. On Tuesday, I met Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany. I said, I'm the new Foreign Secretary. And she said, congratulations, if that's the right word. She had quite a sense of humour. On the Wednesday, I went to the NATO summit in Brussels. This is the infamous NATO summit of 2018 in which Trump nearly pulled America out of NATO. And I sat right behind him and Theresa May, because the United Kingdom sits next to the United States, as he had a huge argument with Angela Merkel about European defense spending. And he came very close, as we now know, to pulling America out of NATO. It would have been absolutely catastrophic for the world. His top advisors had to fly over from the White House to talk him out of it. I shook his hand, but I didn't really. I shook his hand, he said, I've heard great things about you. I thought, he's a great flatterer, Donald Trump, but I don't think he did know anything about me at all. But on that Wednesday, I went to a breakfast to discuss the civil war that was raging in Syria with other Western countries, and the Canadian Foreign Minister, Chrystia Freeland, who's become a very good friend. She mentioned that if Assad were to win in that civil war, there are these very brave humanitarian workers called the White Helmets who we were supporting, and they rescued people from buildings that had been bombed, sometimes with chemical weapons. And she said, if Assad wins, we need to worry about what happens to them, because he'd probably want to execute them all. Anyway, the point is, just imagine where I am at this point. I've been health secretary. I've been the longest serving health secretary. I knew absolutely everything there was to know about how to run a hospital. But foreign policy, literally, I've been there 48 hours. So I didn't say anything. And then on the Friday, so I've been foreign secretary now for 4 days, I have to go to Chequers, the prime minister's country residence, to take part in a bilateral meeting between Donald Trump and Theresa May. Donald Trump on his way back from the NATO summit. There's only about 8 people in the meeting. And I'm thinking, I had a little bit of imposter syndrome. I'm thinking, what am I doing here? And, I don't know anything about foreign policy. How can I possibly add value in this situation? And then I thought, aha, I know what. Theresa May is a fine public servant, but even her closest friends would say she's perhaps not the best in the world at small talk. So if there are any awkward silences, I'm your man. I'm going to step in as her new foreign secretary, and I will just ease things along and make sure that everyone is happy and everything is smooth. So I thought, that's what I'm going to do. And so the meeting started with a presentation from the head of MI6, who's called C, about the Middle East. Trump was on best behavior. The night before, he'd given an interview to The Sun in which he'd said Boris would make a great prime minister, and he was feeling a bit embarrassed, and so he was really being very polite and engaged. So we had this presentation on the Middle East, and Trump said, that's really interesting, but what are we going to do about it? And then we had a silence, a Theresa May classic. And so I thought, maybe this is my moment. And then I thought, well, I'm not quite sure what to say. And this is the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. So I said nothing. And then a few minutes later, we had another silence. And I still couldn't really think of something to say, but my mind was racing. And anyway, when we got to the third Theresa May silence, I said, Mr. President, if Assad wins the civil war, we have got to think about what happens to the white helmets. I got a black look from Theresa May, who didn't know what I was talking about, and it wasn't on the agenda. Trump looked at me and he said, well, are they good guys or bad guys? I said, they're good guys, Mr. President. But then I had a problem, because I had come to the end of the road about my entire knowledge on the topic. And luckily, sitting two away from me was our ambassador to America, Sir Kim Darroch. And he did what all good diplomats do, which is he came to the rescue of the foreign secretary. And he wrote me a note saying the issue was the white helmets could only be evacuated over the border with Israel, and the Israelis wouldn't allow any Syrians over the border. So I said, Mr. President, the issue is the white helmets can only be evacuated over the border with Israel, and etc. And Trump thought for a moment, and he said, well, if they're good guys, we should get them out. And John Bolton, his national security advisor, was sitting next to him, said, I'll square off the Israelis. And after lunch, Bolton came up to me and said, I've squared off the Israelis. And 2 weeks later, 93 white helmets and their families, 400 people in total, were evacuated across the border with Israel, all thanks to Theresa May's silences. So I say this because sometimes the right thing happens against all the odds. And I think the interesting thing about Trump, and maybe we can talk more about this, is that he, for all his faults, he's someone who decides things quickly and is prepared to show that he will do what it takes to change things. And that will be going through Keir Starmer's mind as he prepares to meet him later this week. But I'm going to leave it at that, Tony. Thank you very much indeed, and lovely to see you all.
Very good. It's always good to hear directly about how much, this in the kindly way, how much even high politics is just like normal life at home, really, isn't it? All the same things that, as I always say, we all live in politics day and night at home, so it's sort of a much more serious version than that. Talk about more serious. Just before I open this up, everybody has a chance. I mean, the dangerous world, you've listed a number of the things that make it more, or by implication, more dangerous. And I must say, certainly since Donald Trump has become president, it looked about a little bit less today than it did at one point, as if the post-1945 settlement was coming to an end. It was really going to something that we'd relied on to varying degrees, not just the institutional mechanisms, but a sort of, even during the Cold War, a sense that everybody knew what everybody else would do next, or thought they did. That was all coming to an end. So I suppose my question, what are the key building blocks in the danger that, by implication, the book is worried about? Well, and you did mention some, obviously.
Yeah, no, I mean, Bill Clinton had a very good saying. He said the key in politics is, don't look at the headlines, look at the trend lines. And there are some very disturbing trend lines. We talked about climate change, but if I just talk about sort of geopolitics rather than the climate for a moment, there's an organization in America called Freedom House that tracks the number of fully free countries. And their definition of a fully free country is something we're all familiar with. It's essentially countries like the one we live in, where voters can freely choose a government and freely get rid of a government that they don't like, and where there's freedom of the press and independence of the courts. And the number of fully free countries shot up after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, but for 15 of the last 20 years, it's actually declined. And in fact, now only 20% of the world's population live in fully free countries. And I think we forget that in the UK. We think that the sort of things we take for granted in our political discourse are widespread, but we're actually only one in five human beings on the planet who have that privilege. And that system was the endpoint of the global order that was set up by Winston Churchill and Roosevelt and Truman after the Second World War. And I do believe, for all its faults, and there are many, many faults, and we definitely need to reinvent the way our democracy works at home if we want to advocate for it abroad, but I do believe that liberal democracy has been the most successful way of governing societies in the history of humanity. And if you look since 1945, there are some staggering improvements in science and technology, but most of all in the prosperity of the human race. When I was born in 1966, half the world lived in extreme poverty. That's defined by the UN as an income of less than $2.15 a day. It used to be $1 a day. So you can imagine, if you've got an income of less than a dollar a day, you aren't just poor, you are achingly, excruciatingly poor. Now, when I was born, that was half the world. Now, it's just 9% of the world. And over that period, the population of the world has nearly tripled. That is an incredible advance for humanity, that so many, proportionally so many fewer people are in extreme poverty. And that's because for a long period of time, we stopped fighting each other and started trading with each other. Now, Donald Trump doesn't seem to believe in the free trade.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, he seemed to be prepared to support Russia in the fighting. Thankfully, he has backed off some of the most extreme things he wanted to do on trade and has, I think, come to understand that Putin is not someone who can be trusted. But that's why it is a really dangerous time. And I don't think it is irrecoverable. I think it's absolutely something worth fighting for, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
And of the institutions that were created in this post-1945 world, you touched on the United Nations, but I mean, which of those, and there's plenty of them, political, economic, humanitarian, that have either were created immediately after 1945 or subsequently, which of them do you think Britain needs to do more to shore up or to work with or to try to reinvent? I was at an event, student event actually, a few weeks ago, where somebody who'd worked at the UN made the point that the UN that was created initially wouldn't be the one you'd create today. You'd create it because of all sorts of reasons, different power blocks and so on, that the UN that was originally created is not what you do now. You'd have to do something different. I mean, so should Britain be working to change the way some of these international institutions work, trying to create new ones, whatever?
For sure. Nearly all of them need big reforms. But, I mean, the UN is actually a fantastic institution as long as you don't want it to do anything. And I don't mean that in quite such a trivial way as it sounded, although I did say it that way deliberately. But the truth is that the point of the UN is actually to get nations to talk to each other and to discuss their differences and to try and understand each other a little bit better. And I think for many years it's done that. And actually the Security Council, I remember going to, at the UN General Assembly, going to breakfast of the permanent members of the Security Council. And it was a completely private breakfast, and it was just me, the Russian Foreign Minister, the Chinese Foreign Minister, the American Secretary of State, and the French Foreign Minister, and the Secretary General of the United Nations. And we had, for the most extraordinary hour, a totally frank conversation. This happens every year at the UN General Assembly. It's never leaked. And it's a chance for people to speak frankly. And I think that is the strength of it. But if I was going to say what we need to do to protect the progress that we've made, I think it's to be honest about the failings in our own democracy and be bold in reforming our own democracy. I mean, I'll give you an example. We do virtually no voting online. And that just seems to me crazy in an era where everyone is online most of the time. There are so many decisions that we could give to people, in local communities, ask them to decide whether they want to have a bypass around their town and prepare to pay higher tax for it or whatever. And we our democracy, I think, is stuck in the model of about 50 years ago. And technology, the point of democracy is to give people a sense of control of their own destiny. And too many people don't think that. So I would actually start, I would probably, rather than saying we need to reform the UN or the IMF, I would start by saying, what can we do at home?
Okay, and one last one. Then the current government has radically reduced the aid budget. The United States has radically reduced overseas international aid or international development spending. Do you feel that that is going to help Britain's reputation in this dangerous world?
I've got very mixed feelings. So I do think that if you had to choose between the aid budget and the defence budget, when we have the first major European land war since the Second World War, unfortunately, the defence budget matters more. But I'd rather we hadn't had to make that choice. And I was one of the rebels, actually, when Boris Johnson cut the aid budget. I voted against my party when he put that through Parliament. But I do think the aid budget was quite broken, or has been quite broken for many years. It's a bit like HS2. I love the idea of HS2. We definitely need to have high-speed rail travel in this country. It's embarrassing that we don't have it, considering, you know, that Japan opened its first high-speed rail link between Tokyo and Osaka 2 years before I was born. And I'll be lucky if I'm alive when we open our first one. So, you know, but that doesn't mean to say the project was being well run. It really wasn't. And I think the problem with the aid budget is that we got stuck in a sort of Band-Aid, Live-Aid mentality where all of Africa is incredibly poor, when actually modern Africa is not like that. I mean, if you drive from the airport in Nairobi to downtown, there are these giant billboards and modern office blocks and a multi-lane highway, and most of Africa has got capitalism. I went to Nigeria when I was foreign secretary, and you know, I went and visited a World Food Program effort in the north east of the country where there was a lot of terrible poverty. I was very proud to see what British aid was funding. But when I went to see the government ministers in Abuja, they weren't interested in that at all. They said, can you help us set up our new tech sector? And could the City of London help find funding for it? And so I think that we haven't modernised our aid budget. At its best, it doesn't just alleviate poverty, but it acts as a bridge between north and south, and I don't think it was really doing that.
You know, the matter of HS2, to Japan's great credit, they didn't build it from just outside Tokyo to just outside Yokohama either, did they? Went to the city. Anyway, enough about railways. OK, I'm going to take perhaps a couple of questions, two or three at a time. If you want to, say who you are, speak clearly. My hearing's not brilliant. The acoustics, it's my fault, not the acoustics. So I'll take these two at the front first, but I promise you I'm going to come back. So two ladies at the front. And if you want to say who you are, please feel free to, but don't feel you've got to.
Sure. My name is Susan Wolf, and I wanted to say it's good to see you, Jeremy. I had been attending parliamentary health committee meetings for years, and I was there at your first meeting as chair, and you didn't really know very much about what was going on.
Sorry about that.
Really impressed me, and what I want everybody to know, is that attending those meetings for years, and whenever you spoke, I watched you grow into that position, and it has always impressed me all these years. You took it seriously. You grew into it, it mattered to you. And that later, as chair of that committee yourself, you held people's feet to the fire and made them, and just so good on you. And
thank you.
I think if you'd been health secretary.
Can please all the questions be a bit like this?
Yes.
This is a very good, Susan. It's a great first question. I think everyone is listening and learning and.
And I'm going to be less helpful. Narrow it into a question at the end.
If you had stayed health minister, because you were getting into, and you and I were talking about patient empowerment at that time, and this country would have been ready for the pandemic, and the result, the whole thing would have been different. So I think you're terrific. Okay. I think you're terrific, and I'm glad you got the applause that you got. Okay. So I wanted to say that.
That's very kind of you. Okay, and then further along the front row.
Hi, Mr. Hunt. My name is Natalie, and I'm LSD alumni. Thank you for being here today for sharing about the book. And the fact that you shared that the intro and the influence of UK are reassuring, but I'm questioning whether this influence is slowly diminishing. So, for example, you set out a vision of making Britain more competitive by focusing on innovation in sectors like science and technologies. However, we've recently seen, like, for example, fewer IPO in the UK compared to other financial centers in this area. And even recently, even prominent British companies like AstraZeneca are also considering moving the listing away from the UK. So do you think that this is a sign that, like, British attractiveness is in the, and the influence in the financial sector is under threat? And if so, why do you think that has happened, and what measure would you propose?
Okay, and I will take a third one from the front row, gentlemen. So I promise we'll move back. We're going to be democratic. Try and keep the questions as short as possible.
Yes, Bernard Herrmann. It seems to me the confluence of the issue between democratic and non-democratic worlds is a fate of Taiwan. Now, this is ongoing, and it will explode into the public realm any time now. Britain, because of our English language links with America, will probably find ourselves on the same side as the United States. How do you see that issue proceeding from now onwards?
Okay.
Right. Brilliant questions. Thank you. So, Susan's question about health secretary. Obviously, if I'd been prime minister in the pandemic, my experience as health secretary would have been very useful. The big reform that I mean, I love the NHS, I love its values, the idea that it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, you can always access the healthcare you need. But when it goes wrong, the NHS turns patients into numbers. And the reform that I wish I had been around for longer to properly push through was going back to everyone having their own GP, which we used to have until 2004-05. And there's absolutely no reason we couldn't have now. By the way, I think it would make being a GP a lot more rewarding as well, to see, have their own list of patients, which is what they used to have. We've switched to a system where people are attached to a surgery, but they don't actually have a doctor responsible for them. I think that would mean fewer misdiagnoses and more personal NHS. So that's the thing that I really wish I'd do. Natalie's question. So it's a really important point, and we've got lots of challenges. And the challenges of IPOs, getting more IPOs done in London, is something which I made a lot of reforms to try and change, and I know Rachel Reeves is trying to as well. And I think it's a matter of time. But fundamentally, the thing that I found myself understanding much better when I finished off this book, having been Chancellor, is that there is an iron link between economic strength and political influence in the world. And why am I optimistic about our future? Because outside the United States and China, we have the third largest technology sector, the only one that's worth $1 trillion, apart from the US and China. And that is actually quite a defensible position. There are countries like France that are trying really hard. Macron is trying very, very hard to make France the tech leader. But the reason it's a defensible position is because outside the United States, the UK has the most respected universities, three in the world's top 10. And outside the United States, we have the biggest financial services sector. So a couple of the biggest ingredients for a tech sector we have. And then there's a third one, which is that, you know, the original Silicon Valley happened off the back of a lot of defense spending, and we just increased our defense spending a lot here as well. So I think this is a really big opportunity for the UK. Bernard, I think Taiwan is a potentially very worrying flashpoint. And I think my understanding is that China would like to avoid a forcible unification with Taiwan, because it's very, very high risk for the Communist Party leadership. if all the semiconductor factories in Taiwan closed or went out of action, that would be incredibly damaging for the Chinese economy. So there'd be huge risks, which I suspect they would rather not take. But I think with China, what we have to do is to do two things at the same time that might seem a bit contradictory. We have to be strong and also engage. And you need to be strong because autocrats ultimately only respect strength. And that means we need to make sure our economies sort out their growth problems and get going. But we need to keep talking to them because, you know, without the engagement of China, we will never tackle climate change or all sorts of other global issues. And indeed, we've got to be very careful that we don't have an accidental war because of misunderstandings on both sides about what their intentions are.
Be good, right. I'm going to move up here now. I'll come back to the middle. So, gentleman there, the blue shirt. Sorry to recognise you that way. And then...
Hi. My name's Owen, and as a 16-year-old, I want to know what advice you would give to young people around the country who are looking to get into politics.
Good one.
Okay, and by the wall over there, yeah. Sorry again to describe you as big by a wall. It's not very friendly, is it? Sorry.
Hi, I'm Sam. I'm a student at LSE. You talk about improving our democracy in the UK. The Labour government last week announced its intention to legislate votes for 16 and 17-year-olds and reintroduce the SV system for mayoral elections. Would you go further and say we should introduce PR at the Westminster stage?
Yes, quite a lot of senior Conservatives and indeed senior Labour politicians must be thinking about that at the moment. Let's go back. So, two further, we'll take four this time. There's two guys that are together there, one behind the other, yeah. So, that's it.
Thank you. Hello, Sir Jeremy. Thank you for being here today. And my question is regarding, you talked a lot about dialogue, and I was wondering, in today's political spectrum where there's a lot of competing ideas, a lot of competing parties, and the use of social media in amplifying different political thought, and some not necessarily mainstream, how you think those different factors can contribute together to contribute to a healthy and, I would say, sensible dialogue.
Okay,
and then just one behind us, sure. As we've got the microphone very close.
Hi there, thank you for coming, Sir Jeremy. Do you feel that the bulk of the democratic and economic declinism in this country and in the US is centred in our rural areas? If so, why?
Okay, right. These are great ones. Okay, I'm going to do these in reverse order. I think the disaffection with the system, democracy, the country is often centred in the parts of the country that feel they've been left behind. And they have a sense, particularly in the UK, it's quite straightforward, it's very geographic. You know, London and the South East are the most prosperous region in the whole of Europe. And people outside London and the South East feel very left behind. And we have done far worse than many other similar countries in breaking down those regional disparities. So Manchester has productivity about 40% less than London, whereas Lyon, it's only a 20% gap with Paris, and Osaka and Tokyo have no gap at all, and Munich actually has a higher GDP per head than Berlin. So that is very bad for social cohesion. And I think the thing that we have got to recognize is that this could get even more pronounced in the age of AI, because you could have a small company where just 10 employees are responsible for a turnover of £1 billion or $1 billion. Now, those 10 people are going to be very, very wealthy indeed. But the problem is what happens to all the graduates who can't get jobs and really worry in an AI world. But it's not just the graduates. It's the people who might have been a retail assistant in Tesco's. You go to Tesco now and you get all these screens and they're encouraging you to do your own scanning, and they're employing fewer people. You know, soon we'll have self-driving cars and we won't need Uber drivers. And the really defining challenge of your generation, if I can put it this way, is to make sure we build a society in which everyone feels they've got a chance to be successful and make the most of their talents, and we're going to have to really think that through. The question about social media, I think That is where the Conservative Party, the Labour Party, the traditional parties have gone wrong, because we have not understood how social media works. And, you know, Donald Trump is on TV and on social media for 2 to 3 hours a day. Right? When I was Chancellor, you know, I used to have an interaction with the media once a week. And it was always a bit of a nightmare. And I'd be intensely prepared by my civil servants, and we'd try and work out all the difficult questions that, you know, Nick Robinson was going to ask. And usually we could work it out what they were, and I'd work out my answer. And if I got through the interview without, you know, a terrible gaffe, I would relax for another week. And that was it. And I think that that was how Rishi Sunak and Theresa May treated the media. I think it's how Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves treat the media, not Donald Trump. You know, he is on TV every bloody day. You know, he finds a reason, and he is in social media. And I think that, you know, if you believe in centrist politics, where we're honest with people about trade-offs, and we try our very best to persuade people to embrace long-term solutions, not quick fixes, we've got to get better at understanding social media.
Before we leave that one, just to chip in, it is said that Nigel Farage and Reform are rather better at this than
yes,
the traditional parties.
They are. I just started on TikTok because I heard that Nigel Farage was doing a lot on TikTok, and I'm thinking, God, I don't want him to be reaching the under-30s in my constituency and me not to be there. So, yeah, absolutely. Then Sam's question about PR. You know, I've always been a supporter of a two-party system where you have two parties that are broad churches, and the reason I've liked it is because when a party gets an overall majority, you can then hold them accountable for their manifesto. Whereas if you have coalitions, people can duck out of their manifesto by saying, well, it wasn't, in the end, we couldn't get it agreed with our coalition partners. But we're now in a five-party system, and in Scotland and Wales, arguably a six-party system. And if that carries on, you know, we're getting some very perverse results now, and I think it's going to be a harder case to answer. And then Owen, you know,
do you mean you think we might have to entertain a move to reform the voting system?
I think we might have to think through. I mean, I'll let me be honest, I haven't come to a settled view.
No.
That's why I'm not answering. It's not because I don't want to. I don't really like PR, but you know, if the current system is leading to very illogical results, then we might have to rethink it. No, it's all right. I mean, when you're a government minister, you can never say you haven't made your mind up, so it's quite nice to be able to. And then Owen's question about advice for young people going into politics, such a great question. So I would say that I sometimes think, what is it I wish I'd known when I was 18 about politics? I kind of went into it quite unthinkingly. I thought, oh, it looks really interesting. I'm interested in current affairs. I'll have a crack. What I think I didn't understand was the total roller coaster nature of a career in politics. It's not very meritocratic. The truth is, you can be a very gifted and able politician, but just through bad luck, you never get selected for a parliamentary seat, or you get selected and then your party happens to do really badly and be out of power for 14 years, as just happened to, you know, any Labour politician that was elected in 2010 had to spend 14 years in opposition. And you get these violent changes. So, you know, I was on the backbenches and then I was Chancellor. I really thought I was nothing. And I think that sometimes I probably wouldn't want my own kids to go into politics, which is a terrible thing to say, just because I feel I've been very lucky with my political career. But I don't know, I've obviously got no way of knowing if they would be either. And so I would say this, if you're at LSE, this is one of the best universities in the world, and you have a bloody duty to do some public service. It doesn't have to be politics, but, you know, I think there could be more to your life than just making money for yourself. And politics is a noble profession, despite all its failings.
Very
good book years ago called In Defence of Politics, and it's still a case that's worthy of being made. I'm going to come now to the section at the top here. So the gentleman with his... it's so hard to describe. So, yes, second or third row, arm, wave it, wearing glasses, that's it. And then I'll go along the same row. Yep.
Hello, I really loved your speech. You're really charming.
You're in competition That's with the true. Lady at the front now.
So my
nicest first. Go on, keep going.
There's going to be a but here, I think.
Yes, it's gone. Yeah.
No, there's no but here. Yeah. My question is, while we all criticise Trumpian U-turns and foreign policy, one view goes that Trump is very transactional. He appeals with hard interests. He appeals with hard strength. He appeals to the interests of the opposing party. For example, the quickness with which he recognized the new Syrian regime and removed sanctions. How can countries like ours, which on one side, as you said, are leaders in certain fields like technology, climate change, human rights, how can we appeal and shape the world when we do not seem to be appealing to national interest or have strength of our own, which is hard power?
Okay, very good. Along the line, yep, that's it.
Hi, I'm Niels. I'm doing a master's here. Thank you very much for the very interesting talk. I have a question regarding migration. During your time in government, you've been a big supporter of the Rwanda deal. Do you think that Britain can resolve its migration challenges while remaining a member of the ECHR?
Okay, good question.
And let's take one more. Yep, just bring past the... Can you pass it down? That's it, very good. This is very efficient.
Thank you very much for the talk. My question is a little bit broader about the fact that you said that influential countries have this obligation to influence. How do you reconcile that with the fact that they are often the ones that are making the world a more dangerous place? So in the example of US and UK involvement in the Middle East or China being a threat to democracy, I guess at what point do you curb that influence?
Could you just put your hand up? I couldn't see who was asking. Ah, there. Right. Okay, great.
Can we take one more nearby? Anybody else want a question nearby? Very nearby, not down here. You're cheating now. I'll come to you next, I promise. Nearby, you're about 5-8 rows away. Is somebody else there? Good. I'll come down to you next, I promise.
Jeremy, at the start of your speech, you were very honest and self-deprecating about the fact that when you became Chancellor, you didn't know a lot about financial markets. I wondered whether you would recommend any changes to the way that we run our ministerial and cabinet system to try and have better expertise in place for people to do in these jobs. You know, you've worked in business. The idea of having a CFO who didn't know how to read a P&L would be pretty crazy, but we do it in government.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
They're such fun questions, thank you. Genuinely, no. Let me go through those. So first of all, the gentleman who kindly called me charming. I think actually you make a very good point that... Sorry about that. Donald Trump has won his election because he found a way of appealing to self-interest. And I think it's, we're not going to win an argument for a set of values that may be different to Donald Trump's values without finding a way of marrying it to people's self-interest. And I think that one of the biggest things that's going wrong at the moment is people don't feel that governments, whether conservative or Labour, are able to turn around the economy and therefore offer great economic prospects for people and their families. And if they felt that was in the bag, they would go along with a lot of other things. But they feel very insecure because, putting partisan issues aside, we've had three massive global shocks. with the financial crisis, COVID, and a 1970s energy shock as well. That has meant that growth has been depressed all over the world, but that has made it a very different environment. So I do think you need to find a way of bringing self-interest and national self-interest into the argument. Niels's question about migration. This is something which I have, you know, very strong views on. And the reason is because my wife is Chinese. I did once call her Japanese. And if you want to know the full story of that, it's in the book. But I think that one of the best things about this country is that for centuries we've been open to the brightest and best from all over the world. It's the making of institutions like the LSC and our university sector. And, you know, we have always, London has always been one of the most open and international cities on the planet, and it's made London one of the most exciting cities on the planet. And I am worried that unless we get better at controlling illegal migration and also find better ways to control and bring down legal migration, the social consensus in favour of being open to the brightest and best all over the world will start to fray. And that, by the way, is why a lot of immigrants themselves support tighter controls on migration, because they worry that if we don't get a grip on it, it's going to make this incredible success story. I mean, I think this is one of the most harmonious countries in the world when it comes to bringing people together. It will put that at risk. So I do think that we should have kept the Rwanda scheme. I think there needs to be some kind of deterrent in place. I do think that we need to definitely rewrite the ECHR and the 1951 Refugee Convention, which were written by Brits, actually, in the 1940s with the best of intentions, which was to make sure if there was another Holocaust, Jews would be able to flee more easily. But the world has changed because the world is mobile now. It wasn't mobile then, and they need to be rewritten. And in the end, if we didn't, I mean, I think all the countries in the ECHR have the same worries that we have, and I think there would be strong support. But if they didn't agree to rewrite it, I would support leaving it with a heavy heart. But I think we need to do all these things if we're going to protect that openness of outlook which has been so important to the UK. There was a lady who said, what do we do when the countries that do have influence use it badly? And I think it's a really important point to make. I mean, if you say, you know, who are the two most powerful countries in the world, we would all agree it's the United States and China. Both those countries have profound challenges. There is a polarization in America, which I really hope we never, ever have here. I think that the idea of, you know, a conservative coming to what's thought to be one of our most left-wing universities and having a really constructive discussion, I don't know if that would happen in America these days. And that is really sad. But then you look at China and the problems with the Chinese economy and Xi Jinping not having any officials who tell him the truth because they're all terrified. I mean, you know, there are some really big challenges there. So my argument is that means the rest of us have a real responsibility to work out what influence we have and to use it. And there are lots of countries that feel exactly like we do. You know, of course there are the EU countries, but there's Japan, there's Australia, there's Korea. There are many, many others, and we need to be working together to protect what really matters for humanity. And then finally, great question about why on earth would you put someone who doesn't know about financial markets in as Chancellor? Well, that's because in this country, sorry, I'm going to say, it's going to sound very patronising, but in this country we are a democracy. So we choose our cabinet ministers from people who've been elected to Parliament. And that broadly works, providing that CFO who doesn't understand financial markets, as it were, comes in and knows that the key thing is to have a really good relationship with civil servants who are experts. Their job is to be the institutional memory and to give you really good advice. So this system we have actually works if you have a cabinet minister who can build a relationship of trust and knows when to ask questions. And, you know, I think if you saw Treasury officials in this country, you would be so impressed. They are incredibly hardworking, incredibly decent, incredibly nice. And they were just a joy to work with as I piloted some really difficult questions. When I didn't understand what they were talking about, which is quite often, by the way, I told them. I said, I'm sorry, can you just explain that a bit more slowly? And they would, with great patience, do it. I know it sounds, you're probably thinking, oh my God, how, you know, what's going on? This is like when the markets are collapsing. But that is actually how it works in a democracy. And sometimes, when you come from the outside, it brings real benefits. I don't want to be at all partisan tonight, and I have a lot of time for Rachel Reeves, who I think has a very difficult job. But if I give you one example, I set up my own business. It wouldn't have crossed my mind to scrap inheritance tax relief for family farms and family businesses, because I've just met too many people who've handed down their business generation after generation. And I just don't think it occurred to Rachel that that would be the impact of what she decided to do. And so sometimes having an outside perspective actually is a positive, not a negative.
I'll say, to personal notice, I'm always struck by how soon, when something goes on in the world, I become an expert on the bond market or an epidemiologist, or you do it in about an hour now. It's amazing. Anyway, let's come down to this group of people who got their hands up. Yes, so gentleman in the bow tie, if you don't mind me identifying you in that way.
Don't mind that at all. Thank you very much for noticing.
Very nice it is.
Thank you for your talk, Sir Jeremy. And this question may perhaps look forward to your next book, which may not be such a bad idea. But would you agree that the current trajectory of the UK's national debt is unsustainable? It's increasing. We're now at about 100% of GDP. It's increasing, I think, at about £5,000 per second. And we have seen a government now which is incapable of even reforming basic spending in any meaningful way, which means that this is going to continue. We don't have economic growth to deal with it. So how can a country that is so burdened by debt, maxing out on its credit card, really be a credible power for good in the world when we just can't sort out our own backyard?
Very clear. Right. And one down and... In fact, it's two folk in front, or three, actually. Let's do three people in a line together there. Yep.
Good afternoon. I'm Orian, and a Year 12 student at Michaela Community School. Regarding your definition of great, Britain's past as a colonial power arguably wasn't or didn't have such a great impact on other countries and isn't looked upon very positively, not only in the empire, but outside of the empire. So one notable example being Iran, which has been in the news quite a lot, not only recently, but when you were the secretary, the foreign minister over Nazanin Zaghari, where in 1953, the MI6 overthrew its democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh. So do you think this sort of relationship or image of Britain significantly hinders its ability to forge warm relationships with these countries and means that Britain's viewed with a sense of suspicion and hostility, which prevents any meaningful or effective way that Britain can make itself great?
Okay,
good question.
Next one.
Hi, my name is Aryan. I'm the head boy at the Michaela Community School. I wanted to... I'm kind of building on the question that the gentleman behind me asked. We are facing a cost of living crisis, and my question is, does Britain have to be a great international power when we can't even sort out domestic issues at home?
Thank you for your talk, Sir Jeremy. My name is Ibrahim Fidda. I'm also at Michaela Community School and a member of the Labour Party, unfortunately. I would like to ask you, what advice would you give to Lord Mandelson as he takes the very hard task of being the ambassador to the United States?
Okay, and then I promise you I'm going to go to that group of active hands next.
Okay, great. Well, what a great question. So, first of all, on our national debt, I totally agree with you. So I'll just say something that I have learned about how financial flows work. If you have a deficit... that means that the taxes coming in are less than the cost of running public services like the NHS, the welfare state, then someone has to lend you that money. And more often than not, well, very often a big chunk of it will come from foreigners who are happy to lend you the money, but in order to get the pounds that they need to buy to lend you for your national debt, you will then end up not just with a deficit, but also a trade deficit, because you'll be buying their goods. And that's how they'll be getting the pounds. And in the end, you can't go on for and ever borrowing money from foreigners and importing more goods from foreigners. That becomes a very unstable situation if it perpetuates. And I think that we have to be honest that, you know, we need to live within our means, and you can't do it suddenly, because you would provoke a recession. But we should have a fiscal rule that says that public spending on public services will always grow more slowly than the economy as a whole, and that gradually over time you then are able to bring down the debt. So I have to say a mea culpa, I didn't introduce that rule when I was Chancellor, but I did have to deal with a 72 billion gap in finances, so I had a lot of experience of what can go wrong in these situations. So we got a lot of people from Michaela Community School. By the way, in my next book, there's a whole chapter on the story of Catherine Birbal-Singh and Michaela, and so it's like an absolutely incredible school, and I'm really delighted you're here. So our past as a colonial power. Obviously, this is a really thorny and controversial issue, and people have very strong views either way. And all I would say is that in my experience, it very much depends on which countries you're talking about. So what I found as Foreign Secretary was that there are definitely countries like Iran and like India, interestingly the two you mentioned, which are a little bit frosty with us because of the colonial past and a little bit suspicious. Rightly or wrongly, they have a view about the UK that is rooted in that history. But there are also many other countries that actually have positive feelings to the UK, and sometimes that is also associated with that colonial past. And I think I can look back and I can think of bad things we did and good things we did. But the argument in my book is, if we always compare ourselves to the days when there was a British Empire, we will always underplay our influence, because we're never going to be as influential as we were when a quarter of the world's map was painted pink. But what we need to be doing is looking at how much influence we have today. And, you know, when it comes to Europe, we have the best military, the biggest technology sector. We have more hard power, more soft power than any other European country individually. And that is a lot of influence, and I want us to use it in a positive way. And then, you know, how can we, why are we, this is a great question, by the way, this is a question that Nick Robinson asked me when he interviewed me about the book. Why, how will we persuade people that we should be influential abroad when we can't fix problems at home? Don't voters want you to fix the cost of living crisis? Absolutely. And we won't ever win the argument for being influential in the world unless we get to grips with our economic problems. So you can't do one without the other, for a very simple reason, that a lot of the reason people want British influence abroad is because of our army and our navy and our air force, because of what's happening in Ukraine. We won't be able to afford to fund them unless we've got a strong economy. So you're absolutely right on that. And then Irian, the Labour Party member, you're most welcome. One day I'll get you to see the light.
Or the other way around, perhaps. The other way.
Touché. What advice would I give to Lord Benson? Look, he is way too experienced to want any advice from me. I mean, he is a brilliant operator. But what he understands is that with Donald Trump, it's all about chemistry. And I've met Peter Mandelson many times. And the thing that's engaging about him is that he's very direct to your face. Calls a spade a spade. He doesn't dance around the point. He just says it directly. And I suspect that Trump finds that quite attractive.
Okay, and I promised this collection of hands over here. So
let's, yes, you choose. You've got the microphone. It's democratic. You go.
Hi, my name is Rish. Thanks for the talk. So I want to touch upon a topic, which is, you said you spoke about democracy and how it's a more superior system. I think the problem we have is that, yes, it's great to have a right to vote, but people are not excited about any of the options they're given.
Fair point.
And so I want to get your take on two things. Which one is, why do you think talent in politics has deteriorated significantly? Or at least it feels like that.
Thank you.
And second, do you really think a nation can be great when people are voting yes, but the public is truly not behind its politicians?
Right, okay. And then, you can see, a mixture of people. We have a female speaker. We haven't had one for a while. We have a female speaker for questioner. Yeah, you can get it. All right, then move on. Yeah.
Good evening, Sir Jeremy, and thank you very much for your presentation. You're among friends, so... one question I have for you is, what do you consider to be the main reason why the Conservatives lost last year? Do you think the timing of the election being late in the year would have had an impact, especially as Nigel Farage might have been more embedded in Washington politics rather than British politics? And related to that, where do you see the Conservative Party in 10 years from now, and how you bring in some of your thoughts this evening in seeing that revival?
And let's take a couple of female questioners, please.
Thank you, Sir Jeremy. My question is, so findings from the latest British Social Attitudes Report from the National Centre for Social Research last year suggested that trust and confidence in Britain's system of government is at a record low. In terms of focusing on domestic issues within the UK, how can politicians regain the trust of their citizens given the partisan nature in a world filled with misinformation and the growth and development of AI?
And we'll take one more.
Hi, thank you for your talk. My name's Inaya. I just wanted to ask that given US-China bipolarity, how realistic would you say that your vision of Britain as this strategic middle power, if you will, is rather than a sort of diplomatic appendage to Washington? Thank you.
Okay. Wow, I love these. Right. Let's. So let me just make a little defense of politicians, because I'm the first to say that we haven't got everything right. But I also think it's important to put everything into context. And in the 14 years that I was in government, we had three massive economic shocks. We've never had that in our lifetimes before. We've had one shock at a time, maybe once every 10, 15 years, but we had three. And they all required massive cuts in public spending and massive increases in taxation. And, to coin a phrase, at the end of all of that, people were pretty pissed off. And I think that although the Conservative government made lots of mistakes, the fundamental, most important duty we had was to put the economy back on its feet after the global financial crisis, after COVID, and after the energy shock. And we did take the difficult decisions that needed to be taken as a result of that. And so I think actually in that area we did the right thing, but one of the results was that people were really angry after 14 years. They could see that the economic growth had been much higher before the financial crisis. It slowed right down. And there were, by the way, lots of problems that we didn't address as much as I would have liked to, like the housing crisis. So lots of young people felt, how am I ever going to get a foot on the housing ladder? And that's something I hope this government really does address, because it's so important. But I think that's why people were so angry. And that's why, going to the next question, I don't think that we could have done anything that would have changed the outcome of that election. The timing of the election, you can toss a coin, but people wanted the Conservative government out last year, and one way or another, that was going to happen. And I think, even though will always be a Conservative, I now do want the Labour government to succeed. They're going to be in office for, another 3 or 4 years, and it's my country, and I really hope that they do tackle some of the big problems that we didn't tackle. because I think the country needs to see that their elected politicians are actually able to tackle the big problems of the day. Now, trust. I think that we have shot ourselves in the foot as politicians by coming across as very inauthentic in the way we appear on television. I think when you hear, you know, politicians, you know, for example, today Steve Reed, the Environment Secretary, announced big new plans for the water industry. I passionately want those plans to work because my constituents are as angry about dirty rivers as I am, and my government tried to do lots of things, but we need to make a lot more progress. But he had come out with a script, and it was basically all because of the terrible mess that we inherited, we've had to do A, B, and C. And I think what you hear, if you're apolitical, is one set of politicians slagging off another set. And in the end, you think, can't we do better than this? And by the way, Conservatives did exactly the same. You know, we were always talking about the Labour government that ran out of money and all that stuff. So I'm not saying that we're above it either. That's what everyone does. And I just think that in the end, that destroys trust. And, you know, I will say this about Donald Trump, and I think you've probably heard enough of me tonight to know that I'm not usually his biggest fan. But when he speaks on TV, on those daily TV appearances we're getting used to, you do feel it's the real him. You do feel that he's actually saying what he thinks. Now, sometimes this is stuff that you profoundly disagree with, you know, what he said about Ukraine or Putin or tariffs or climate change, but you think it's what he really believes. And I think one of the reasons we've lost trust is that too often people worry the politicians are giving them a line, a party line, and not what they really believe. And then Anaya's question, you know, with the US and China so enormous, is it realistic for us to be a sort of a strategic middle power? The answer is, on our own, no. But there are lots of other countries that feel the same as us. And, you know, with the problems that we're seeing in the US and China, I'd like us to be working really closely with the Australias, the Japans, the Koreas, the Frances, the Germanys, the countries that share our values and our worldview, to make sure that that doesn't get lost in all the noise. And I think this is a moment to really redouble efforts to do so.
Okay, it's nearly 8 o'clock. I haven't any questions here. I'm going to take one or two questions, and they're short and sharp from the front here. So one, yes, I'm sorry, everybody with the microphones. Right down the front. Person with a hand up. There. Okay.
Thank you to Jeremy, and very interesting. I'm actually going to briefly go over a period that I feel is very similar to what's happened today.
Very, very briefly, if you can, because we are...
Yeah, I will. I'll be very brief. Before the Second World War, there was a breakdown in trade. There were the trading blocs, the dollar, the sterling, franc, etc. There were strong leaders in Europe. As a result of that, there was a war. And we had a very strong leader who I didn't realise was actually second. It was conditioned that Attlee joined the cabinet, the war cabinet, on condition that Winston Churchill becomes prime minister. I didn't know that till the other day. Anyway, at the moment, in this country, with those problems that we have, who do you see in the House of Commons being that leading minister?
Okay, that would be a good... Let's take that one question. It's a nice short one to end on. Good.
Okay, great. Well, so we have been blessed at critical moments in our history to have extraordinary leaders, whether it's the Pitts or the Gladstones or the Churchills or the Thatchers, or after that, you know, charismatic leaders like Tony Blair was. Whether you agree with all of the things they did or said, they were leaders of the highest calibre. And I believe that our system will continue to produce those leaders on a regular basis. I'm not saying that you would necessarily believe that about the crop that we have in the House of Commons, myself included. But a good political system can survive and prosper even with lower key leaders. And I think that, you know, you can't build your country's future saying, when's the next great leader going to come? What you need to do is to build a system which allows people who aren't Thatchers and Churchills. I mean, I don't think Keir Starmer would mind me saying that he's probably not in the caliber of Winston Churchill. But there's an awful lot of good that he could do in the next 3 to 4 years. And, you know, I think we all want to wish him well and hope that he does it. And I do believe that our system, there is space for the John Majors, if you like, the slightly lower key leaders who can actually do very good and important things.
Right, I'm going to do a bit of choreography, say thank you, a bit of choreography here. In order that we can get the speaker to the back of the room in order to sit down and sign any books you'd like to have signed, we need to keep a space here while he and I rush up, but after I've said a couple more words. So first, a couple more words. So first, thank you so much for coming along this evening, talking about what's really good about politicians who have held many of the great offices of state, coming and giving us a window in not only to the moments when you were holding them, but into the intricacies of the thought processes that go not through your mind then, but more importantly, after. So I realise this is one of a series of books, so I very much hope we can invite you to come back and talk about the other two, is it?
Maybe. Yes?
Well, yes. Thank you very much. Thank you. Sir Jeremy Hunt.
Thank you very much.
Listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.